On a dusty road somewhere in archaic Greece, a man in late middle age walks with a staff, a cloak, and a voice that can still fill a hall. The road runs between little polis and scattered farms, past shrines with their painted images of the gods, Athena with her spear, Apollo with his bow, Zeus hurling thunder from a human hand. At each stop, this man recites verses for his supper, like any rhapsode. But his poems do something unusual. They bite the hand that feeds him. He praises the city, yes, and sings of wine in moderation. But he also mocks the gods whose statues stand above the people, and he tells them they do not know what they think they know. His name is Xenophanes of Colophon, and in the long line of Greek thinkers, he is one of the first to direct reason not just at nature, but at religion and at human certainty itself. He was born around 570 BCE in Colophon, a city on the Ionian coast of Asia Minor, a world not so far from that of Thales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes. Yet his life soon took a different turn. At some point, perhaps in his 20s or 30s, he was driven from his home by war or political upheaval. He became, by necessity, a wanderer. Later traditions speak of him spending decades on the road, performing in symposia and public gatherings throughout the Greek world, in Sicily, in southern Italy, in the cities of Magna Graecia. He would have lived by his tongue, paid in food, lodging, and gifts for his recitations. Unlike the more settled Milesian philosophers, who could think and teach in one place, Xenophanes' philosophy grew out of constant movement, out of watching how different communities praised their gods, boasted of their athletes, and boasted of their knowledge. We do not have a book of his called On Nature or On the Gods. What we have are fragments of his poems, preserved because later authors quoted them, a few lines here attacking Homer, a stanza there criticizing the cult of athletic glory, a cluster of verses proposing a new way to think about the divine, another about the limits of human knowing. Out of these shards, a coherent voice emerges, skeptical, sharp, ironic, yet also devout in his own way. He is not an atheist. He is a reformer who believes that the traditional stories about the gods are both morally damaging and intellectually absurd. Imagine him at a banquet in some Western Greek city. The men are reclining on couches, servants moving with wine jugs, a flute player in the corner. The walls are decorated with scenes from myth: Heracles wrestling, Aphrodite seducing, Zeus enthroned. Someone has just recited from Homer, perhaps the scene where the gods are feasting on Olympus, while humans suffer on the plain below. The atmosphere is pleasant, self-congratulatory. They belong to a culture with great poetry, great heroes, great gods. Xenophanes rises to speak, taking up the poet's place, but instead of flattering the tradition, he begins to question it. He reminds them, in verse, what Homer and Hesiod actually say about the gods, that they steal, commit adultery, deceive one another, rage, sulk, and behave in ways that would shame any respectable citizen. How can such beings be models for human behavior? How can we pretend that worshiping them will make us better? It is not just that the myths are childish, they are corrupting. If you teach people that the gods themselves cheat and lie, you give them a divine excuse for their own vices. From there, he moves to an even sharper point. Not only are the gods in these stories morally questionable, they are suspiciously familiar. They look like the people who worship them. Greek gods are Greek in face and body. The Ethiopians, he observes, imagine their gods as dark and snub-nosed. The Thracians imagine theirs as blue-eyed and red-haired. If animals could paint, he adds in one of his most famous lines, horses would draw their gods as horses, and oxen as oxen. The pattern is clear. Each culture projects its own features upward and calls the result divine. This is not revelation from above. It is reflection from below. In a few strokes, he has turned the religious imagination inside out. The images on the walls no longer look like windows into a higher realm. They look like mirrors. Instead of gods making humans in their image, humans have made gods in theirs. To say this, in a world where Homer is the educator of Greece and the stories of the gods underwrite the entire social order, is more than impolite. It is a kind of intellectual blasphemy. Yet Xenophanes does not stop at criticism. He also sketches, in cautious phrases, a different way to think about the divine. He says there is one God, greatest among gods and men, not at all like mortals in body or in thought. This God does not run about, does not disguise himself as a swan or a bull, does not fight with other gods. He always remains in the same place, not moving at all, and it is not fitting for him to move from place to place. Still, he is not inert. He shakes all things by the thought of his mind, Xenophanes says, and he sees as a whole, thinks as a whole, hears as a whole. These lines are dense. On the one hand, Xenophanes still speaks in the language of Greek religion. Greatest among gods and men suggests a hierarchy, not the elimination of other deities. On the other hand, the god he describes is nothing like the Olympian crowd. He is not anthropomorphic, not limited by parts, not subject to motion or passion in the ordinary sense. He is a unified, all-knowing, all-seeing intelligence that by mere thinking orders the world. Some later readers will hear in this the first Greek step toward monotheism, a move from a family of bickering divine persons toward a single perfect being. Others will call it henotheism, reverence for one supreme God without denying the existence of lesser divine realities. However we label it, the crucial point is that Xenophanes is using the tools of philosophy, argument, analogy, and critique, to purify and reshape the idea of God. Notice what he strips away. Bodily form, local movement, moral vice, rivalry with other gods. Notice what he preserves. Mind, power, perception, the ability to affect all things. He does not say how this God created the world or whether he did. He does not describe a revelation, a law, or a chosen people. There is no myth of origin replacing the old ones. Instead, there is a conceptual profile. If there is a being worthy of the name divine, Xenophanes suggests, he must be maximally unlike the flawed, partial creatures we know. He should think without error, perceive without limitation, and act without needing limbs. In this way, Xenophanes becomes one of the earliest theorists of negative theology. We know more about what God is not than what God is. He is not like us. From this vantage, Xenophanes looks ahead to later thinkers like Plato, Aristotle, and even certain theologians of monotheistic religions. Plato will imagine a highest form of the good beyond being in dignity and power. Aristotle will describe an unmoved mover, pure actuality, thinking itself. The monotheistic traditions will speak of a God who is omniscient, omnipotent, and not composed of parts. Xenophanes does not spell all this out, but he points in that direction by his refusal to let the divine be drawn in human shape. His critiques are not limited to theology. He is also one of the earliest explicit skeptics about human knowledge. In another fragment, he says that no man has seen the clear truth about the gods and about all things he speaks of. Even if someone were, by chance, to say something completely true, he would not know it. All is woven together out of opinion. This is a startling claim in a culture that values poets and sages as conveyors of wisdom. Xenophanes undercuts the very idea that mortals can have certainty about the deepest things. Our best efforts, he says, produce doxa, opinion, belief, not episteme, secure knowledge. We grope, we conjecture, we may land on the truth, but we cannot know for sure that we have. At first, that sounds like resignation. But in another fragment, he says that the gods have not revealed all things to mortals from the beginning. Instead, by seeking, over time, we discover better. This introduces an important nuance. We cannot have infallible knowledge, but we can make progress. Human understanding can improve, not by waiting for divine disclosure, but by inquiry. This is a modest but powerful epistemology. Xenophanes refuses grand claims to certainty, yet he encourages the slow work of investigation. It is a stance that anticipates both the humility of later skeptics and the fallibilism of modern science. His own practice illustrates this. Alongside his theological poems, we find verses in which he offers natural explanations for phenomena that traditionally religion treats as omens or manifestations of divine temper. Lightning, he suggests, may come from clouds rubbing against each other, not from Zeus hurling bolts. Rainbows, he says, are not the path of a goddess named Iris, but a kind of colored cloud. When he sees fossilized shells and fish impressions on inland rocks, he infers that the land once lay under the sea. The earth, he speculates, is mixed with water, and in the beginning, all things were mud. Such statements put him in the company of early natural philosophers who sought to understand the world in terms of physical processes rather than divine narratives. If you imagine him again at that banquet, you can picture how such remarks would land. The same man who has just challenged the anthropomorphic gods now tells you that thunder and rainbows do not need divine agents. That the seas have receded, leaving traces on the mountains. He admits he does not know these things with certainty, but he believes reason and observation make them plausible. In his worldview, the gods do not micromanage nature. The world operates according to its own patterns. Piety becomes less about appeasing divine whims and more about living with due reverence and moderation within a lawful cosmos. This ethical dimension is clear in another set of verses where he criticizes the Greek obsession with athletic victory. In many cities, he complains, they honor the man who wins a foot race or a wrestling match more than the man who speaks wisely. They reward the athlete with front row seats at festivals, rich meals at public expense, civic prestige. Yet, he says, a city is not made better by someone's speed in running or strength in fighting, but by thoughtful counsel and just legislation. To crown the fastest runner as if he were the greatest benefactor is to mistake bodily excellence for civic virtue. Here again, he cuts against the grain of his culture. In the same era, cities were erecting statues to Olympic victors, and poets like Pindar composed elaborate odes in their honor. Xenophanes does not deny that physical excellence is admirable. He simply thinks it is overrated and misaligned with the true needs of a polis. His criticism anticipates later philosophical debates about the nature of arete, excellence, virtue. Is it something displayed in the body and the battlefield, or something that primarily concerns the soul's capacity for justice, discernment, and self-control? Xenophanes' own ideal seems to be moderation and clarity. In a symposium poem, he lays out how a well-run drinking party should be. The room should be well-ventilated. The guests should be moderate in their eating and drinking. Discussion should center on virtuous topics, especially the gods as they truly are, not on sordid tales or partisan squabbles. Excessive drinking, loud boasting, and crude songs dishonor the occasion. A well-ordered symposium, by contrast, reflects a well-ordered soul and a well-ordered city. Already we see the outlines of the later Greek image of the good life as one of measure and harmony, not excess and display. The traveling life likely sharpened his eye for these themes. As an exile and a guest in many cities, Xenophanes would have seen the variations of custom and cult, different rites, different favorite myths, different heroes. The very diversity of practices would have made it easier to see each one as contingent, not absolute. If the Ethiopians imagined dark gods, the Thracians light ones, and the Colophonians yet others, perhaps none of them has direct access to divine reality. The local gods may be masks over a deeper, more unified truth, or they may be fictions altogether. His famous remark about horses drawing horse-shaped gods is not only a joke at the expense of animal piety, it is a quiet relativization of all human religious imagery. He lived through, or at least near, a time of upheavals that also would have colored his thinking. The Persian Empire's expansion westward threatened the independence of Ionian cities. Greek communities in Sicily and Italy were grappling with oligarchies, tyrannies, and democratic experiments. In such a world, the old assurances of divine favor must have felt fragile. Xenophanes does not turn that fragility into despair. He turns it into a spur for more critical thought. If the gods of Homer can fall into traps and wounds, can be deceived and bound, perhaps they are not gods at all. If the world's events appear chaotic and unjust when viewed through the lens of divine family drama, perhaps we need a different lens. One of the more intriguing aspects of his thought is its possible connection to Parmenides, the philosopher of Elea, who will later argue that reality is one, ungenerated, and unchanging, and that all talk of coming to be and change is misleading. Some ancient sources suggest that Xenophanes was Parmenides' teacher, or at least his intellectual predecessor in Euia. The historical evidence is thin, but intellectually there is a link. Xenophanes' insistence on a single greatest god, his critique of anthropomorphic multiplicity, and his sense that human beliefs are mostly opinion could easily have seeded a more radical monism. Even if he did not formulate a fully worked-out ontology, his stress on unity and on the inadequacy of common belief prepared the ground. In that light, we can see him as a transitional figure between the earliest cosmologists and the more austere metaphysicians. Thales and Anaximenes ask, "What is the world made of?" Anaximander asks, "What kind of principle could generate opposites?" Pythagoras says, "The structure is numerical." Xenophanes says, "Whatever the structure is, it is not what our poets have said, and we cannot know it with certainty. We can only move closer by criticizing illusions and formulating more reasonable images of the divine and of nature." Parmenides will then say, "The very idea of multiplicity and change is deceptive. Reality is a single, undivided being." Without Xenophanes' destructively honest look at myth and opinion, it is hard to imagine that later, more radical step. At the same time, Xenophanes is more than a stepping stone. His vision of a god who is all eye, all mind, all ear, who moves all things by thought alone, is one of the earliest expressions of the idea that rationality and divinity belong together. The divine is not a huge body with superhuman muscles. It is a mode of knowing and willing that does not falter. This will become a staple of philosophical theology later. His critique of anthropomorphism remains relevant wherever religions depict gods with very human traits and passions. His warning that even our true statements are entangled with opinion anticipates the endless modern debates about the limits of human cognition. We can imagine him, near the end of his long life, in some Western city, like Elia, or perhaps back near his Ionian roots, still reciting, still prodding his listeners. He has seen wars, exiles, regime changes, and the rise and fall of local powers. The gods of whom Homer sang have not descended to rescue anyone. Storms and earthquakes have come for the pious and impious alike. He has watched men crowned for their speed, only to die young, and others ignored despite their insight, only to be remembered later. Through it all, he has kept writing and reciting lines that, in their mixture of satire and seriousness, feel almost modern. If cattle and lions had hands and could paint, they would paint the gods as cattle and lions. No man knows the truth, and even if he did, he would not know that he knows. In all things, by searching, we discover better. For a listener today, Xenophanes offers a double invitation. On one hand, he models a way of being religiously serious without being naive. He refuses childish images of the gods and insists that whatever is worthy of worship must also be worthy of respect by an intelligent mind. He will not tolerate tales of divine adultery and fraud dressed up as wisdom. On the other hand, he models intellectual modesty. He does not replace the old myths with a new dogma that he claims to possess infallibly. Instead, he holds his own reconstructions lightly as better hypotheses, not final answers. That combination, critical of tradition yet wary of new certainties, is rare. Philosophical history is full of iconoclasts who smash old images only to demand absolute allegiance to their own ideas. Xenophanes spends much of his energy loosening attachments, loosening the belief that gods must look like us, loosening the confidence that poets have special access to truth, loosening the grip of athletic and aristocratic ideals on the public imagination. What he offers in their place is less a system than an attitude, one that expects error, admires inquiry, and seeks a conception of the divine that is morally and intellectually coherent. When you present him as a bonus episode after Heraclitus and the Milesians and Pythagoras, you can lean into that attitude. Tell the story of the wandering poet who looks up at the painted gods and sees human faces staring back. The exile who notices that each city's certainties contradict the next. The early naturalist, who looks at fossils and rainbows and hears thunder, and suspects that natural processes, not divine tempers, lie behind them. The thinker who dares to say that no human being sees the whole of things, but that it is still worth trying, slowly, to see a little more clearly. In doing so, you will be preserving one of the earliest voices in the Western record that calls for both reverence and critique, for both piety and doubt. Xenophanes is not as famous as Pythagoras or Heraclitus. There are no high school theorems with his name on them, no mystical fragments about the ever-living fire. But he is one of the first to turn philosophy toward the question of how we speak about the divine and how we justify our beliefs at all. His insistence that even if a man should chance to say the complete truth, yet he himself does not know it, could be read in a modern seminar on epistemology without feeling out of place. And there is one more sense in which he is surprisingly contemporary. In an age where images are everywhere, where gods and ideals are constantly rendered in human form or in the form of our own preferences and group identities, his warning about projection still stings. We are still prone to fashion our gods, or our theories, or our heroes, in our own image. To imagine that what we are most familiar with must be universal and ultimate. Xenophanes, walking that dusty road with his staff, invites us to pause and ask, how much of what we call sacred or true is just ourselves reflected back? And can we, with patience, imagine something greater?
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. 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 else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere.